Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, Democrats won big in several key races on Tuesday in what some are calling a referendum on President Trump. Residents of Sutherland Springs, Texas, struggled to recover following the mass shooting on Sunday, the deadliest one in U.S. history to occur in a small town. And more fallout from the Harvey Weinstein sexual harassment scandal. New reports claim the disgraced movie mogul hired spies to intimidate his accusers. I talk with journalist Rebecca Traister about her own encounter with Weinstein and her take on where this is going.
The lessons that it taught me were about power and how it worked.
I want to caution listeners about some extremely crude language Rebecca quotes Weinstein as using toward her. Then,
when you reach my age and stage, and you love the country, and you see a situation in which the country is deepening into a period of peril, you say to yourself, I can't stay silent.
Former CBS News anchor Dan Rather on political divisions and his embrace of social media. First, joining me from a studio in New York City is Rebecca Traister. She's writer-at-large for New York Magazine and The Cut, and contributing editor at Elle Magazine. Rebecca, it's great to talk with you again.
It's wonderful to be back with you, Diane. Thanks for having me.
I must say, as we are beginning our conversation on Thursday afternoon at 1 o'clock, a brand new story has just broken about Roy Moore. The Washington Post is reporting this. Tell us what's happening there, Rebecca.
Well, according to the story in the Washington Post, there is a woman who is alleging that when she was a teenager, when she was 14, I believe in the late 1970s, she was approached by Roy Moore, who was then an assistant district attorney and 32 years old, and befriended by him. And he, in the following weeks, took her out, touched her inappropriately, touched her over her bra and underwear, and pursued a sexual relationship with her. That account, it's published in the Washington Post. Of course, Roy Moore is now the Republican Senate candidate in Alabama, having beat Luther Strange a couple of months ago. And the Post is reporting that there are other women who are telling similar stories about Moore befriending them when they were teenagers. Though I believe the other women who have spoken to the Post said that the sexual contact never went beyond kissing. So that is the story. It seems like it's likely to be a bombshell story. It's a very ugly one, as so many of the stories we're reading right now
indeed
are.
And Rebecca, we have certainly this week been talking about film producer Harvey Weinstein. And I understand that you personally had a scary encounter with Weinstein years ago. Tell us what happened.
I did. My encounter with him was in no way sexual. I was a young reporter. I was 25 years old and working at the New York Observer, which is a weekly newspaper in New York City. And I was working on a story. I then covered the film business in New York City, the sort of financing and production of movies in New York. And I was working on a story about a Miramax movie, and it had to do with the political climate. It was just, in fact, the night that this happened was the night before the 2000 election. And I was trying to get Harvey Weinstein, who is the head of Miramax, to return my calls and comment on this story. And I was a young reporter. It's not surprising. Nobody was calling me back from Miramax. Harvey certainly wasn't calling me back. And he was hosting a book party that night. And my editor — this is a very sort of standard practice in journalism — my editor had another reporter, who wrote the gossip column for the paper, who was going to cover Harvey's book party that night. And my editor said to me, why don't you go with Andrew, cover the party, you'll be able to get a comment from Harvey about the story, and then you'll be able to put it in your story and you'll have reached him for comment. So I went down to the party with my colleague. At the time, I also happened to be dating him, my colleague Andrew Goldman. We went to cover the party. I approached Harvey with a microphone, with a tape recorder. I asked him my question about his movie. He gave me an absolutely weightless comment. You know, oh, I don't know anything about that. That's my brother's movie. His brother Bob was running the part of Miramax that was called Dimension Studios. I don't know anything about that. It's my brother's movie. Fine. I had the comment I needed. I had told him, you know, the premise of my story, and he'd responded. So I sort of got ready to go. And he came back to me and grabbed me by the shoulder and said, you know, you can't use that comment. That was off the record. And I said, well, no, Harvey, you didn't say it was off the record. And I identified myself as a reporter, and you can't retroactively take it off the record. You know about dealing with reporters. And he became incredibly irate. I don't know in retrospect how I had the wherewithal to sort of say that to him. I was very young, and I'd never been in a circumstance quite like this at that point. And he started pushing his finger into my shoulder. This was at a book party at the Tribeca Grand Hotel. It was there were 100 people around, a lot of reporters. And he started to yell at me and push his finger into my shoulder and scream at me about how did this woman get in here? How did you get in here? You're not here to cover this party. He kept calling it a cancer party. The book it was promoting was a book by Karen Duffy, who is a former MTV VJ who'd written about her recovery from an illness that, in fact, I don't believe was cancer, but he kept calling it a cancer party. So among the things I remember he said, and I was holding my tape recorder up, and there was a recording of this for many years, but it has been lost now, 17 years later. I believe what he said was, who let this cunt into this cancer party? And then he said, and this would later get picked up, he said, you know what, this is what's wrong with this town. I'm glad I'm the fucking sheriff of this fucking piece of shit fucking town. And all the while he's screaming at me and backing me, I kept moving backwards, and all I could do was hold my microphone, my tape recorder up to his face, you know, as my only defense mechanism. I couldn't believe this was happening. His publicists were sort of trying to grab him. Everybody in the room was looking. And at some point, in this, my colleague, Andrew, comes over and calms him down by talking to him about the book party. He said, okay, let's talk about this book, Harvey. And I ran off, turned my tape recorder off, scurried to get my things, my bag, my coat. And I was like, okay, let's go. And at that point, Andrew decided that he wanted to try to extract an apology from Harvey and said, I think you owe my colleague an apology. This was an error. This was a strategic error on his part, because Harvey again exploded and pushed him down over a couple of stairs. Andrew was holding his tape recorder. It was a leveled, you know, a party room that had sort of multiple levels. Andrew fell back over stairs with his tape recorder in his hand, hit a woman who was standing at the party in the head. She fainted. And then Harvey started screaming. He hit a woman. He hit a woman and grabbed Andrew and took him out on the street onto 6th Avenue and put him in a headlock and started to try to beat him on the top of his head.
Oh, my gosh.
And the remarkable thing, you know, I've told this story before. It obviously had a tremendous impact on me. I remember being in just absolute disbelief. This was a party that was crawling with reporters. It was a book party. It was a publicity stunt for this book. There were people with cameras there out on the street as Andrew was being pummeled. There were flashes going off all around us.
But not one photo came out in the press.
I never saw a photo. I had sort of hoped, I wrote about this a few weeks ago after the Weinstein stories of grotesque sexual assault came to light. I wrote about my own experience, and in the back of my mind I thought, well, maybe somebody still has a negative somewhere and I'll wind up seeing it now, but I still haven't seen one. The lessons that it taught me were about power and how it worked. And that's, I think, the key to so much of the kind of reporting we're seeing now about sexual assault and sexual harassment in workplaces. So much of it is about power imbalance and not even about sex. And here was an instance in which the kind of abuse that I witnessed and you know, was the recipient of, wasn't about sex. It was about power. Not only the ability to be in a room and scream obscenities at a young reporter. Harvey, at that point, I can't remember, he must have been in his 50s. He was an immense man, really physically imposing. He was very powerful. This was the height of him sort of winning Oscars. And one of the reasons I was writing the story was because he was already very engaged in presidential politics. He was supporting the Gore-Lieberman campaign. And part of the story I was reporting was on maybe his reluctance to release a certain film because it might interfere with his political prospects. He was ambitious politically as well. He was a very powerful man. But the ability – and I was a 25-year-old reporter and my colleague was a 28-year-old reporter.
Sure.
And the ability to sort of behave that way so obscenely, so aggressively, so unprofessionally – and think that you can get away with it. But then the miraculous thing was he was right. He could.
Because nobody, whatever. You did not write about the story back then.
Well, that's an interesting question. I was instructed not to write about that story.
Uh-huh.
I was directly, and this is something a couple people have asked me about this. I was a young reporter. I was just learning how to be a journalist. And I had a couple of editors who I admired and trusted profoundly. And this was a different time. Remember, this was before blogs, before sort of social media.
Sure.
And there was still, I think there were discussions about journalistic ethics and journalistic traditions. And what my editor told me, my top boss told me at the time, was I was not to write about it because if I did, I would be making myself a part of the story.
Oh, my.
And that as a beat reporter who covered Hollywood, or rather New York's Hollywood, this would screw up my perspective on the beat that I covered. It would create unwieldy power dynamics that would make it difficult for me to cleanly cover the figures I needed to cover. I remember the phrase he used with me. He's like, Harvey's always going to be there. Harvey is Russia. He's just – you're always going to be covering Harvey. And if you write about your personal experiences with him, it's – you're never going to be able to write about him cleanly.
Wow.
The other thing I was told, and this is also, I think, a reflection on power, is that I was not to talk to any journalists who wanted to write about what had happened. Because there were reports in the next day that there had been this altercation. Reporters did call to get comment. But I was a good girl, and I did what my editor told me, and I did not comment to any of the reporters from the New York Times or the New York Post or a place called Inside.com that all wrote little squibs about it the next day. But other people did, including Miramax, and they were able to spin it. And the spin, and I've since gone back and looked at the coverage that appeared in the Times and the Post, the spin is what's remarkable. It's that I was the aggressor. I had barged into this party and shoved my tape recorder in his face. You know, it's a complete rewriting in which the person with far less power is made out to be the threatening aggressor and the disruptive force.
Of course.
And I think you see that more largely now as soon as we begin to hear about witch hunts and these poor men being hunted down because of this news cycle, you're seeing that writ far larger in our contemporary conversation, that the women who are telling their stories are the aggressors here.
And Rebecca, I want to ask you about Ronan Farrow's piece with Harvey Weinstein's army of spies.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you make of that.
Well, I found it incredibly chilling. I also found it incredibly plausible for, based on my own experience and one thing I've never written about or actually publicly talked about my own experience, because it was all just hearsay to me then, but I'll talk about it now and why reading that piece in which Ronan Farrow reports on the lengths that Harvey has gone to over the years to cover up his behavior and to threaten anyone who might expose his abuses, hiring ex-Mossad agents to pose, to sort of spy on women and journalists who were working to tell the truth about Harvey's predation. It's a very chilling, horrifying piece. And I will tell you that I immediately recognized something in it. And this is something I haven't talked about because it always felt so fakely dramatic. It couldn't have been true. In the months after I had my little altercation with Harvey compared to these other stories of monstrosity, I was told by someone who worked at Miramax that I was being followed by a detective.
Ugh.
And I've never said that out loud before because it feels so implausible. Why would anyone have followed me? You know, what did Harvey care? I was some 25-year-old dolt who'd been spun in the media. You know, I was posing no threat to him whatsoever. And so it always felt to me like it was overdramatic that somebody would have said this. The reason it came up in conversation is because both my colleague, boyfriend, and I felt actually as though we had some weird feeling that we were being followed.
Oh, my.
And we sort of talked about it conversationally with our friends, and somebody I knew who I was quite close to at Miramax said to me, yes, Harvey is having you followed. There's a private detective.
Oh,
and
my.
It went on for a few months. And in the years after, but again, I don't know. I haven't gone back and reported that myself. I'm saying that to you conversationally, and I'm expressing it as this was a rumor and one that I always found almost too cinematic to be believable. But then I read Ronan Farrow's reporting about ex-Mossad agents, and I think, oh, maybe that rumor wasn't out of proportion. Maybe that story was true. The other thing is that I have written about how in the years between my experience with him and the reporting that has finally come out about his pattern of abuse, there were many reporters who tried to tell this story. And because I'd had a public interaction with him, many of them came to me asking about my experience and asking if I knew anything. And so in my conversations with those other reporters over years, each and every one of them, if Harvey knew that they were writing a story about him, each and every one of them expressed in one way or another that they felt their phone was being tapped.
Oh, my.
They felt they were being – it was all gut feelings. It was all gut feelings.
Yeah.
You know, I hear funny noises. I don't know. There's something with my phone line. And so for me, reading that story about the extraordinary and terrifying lengths that he did go to dig up dirt on people he imagined might one day oppose him, to leverage his power against them. I mean, that's, again, what this is about. It is about power. It's about his ability to say to somebody who might challenge his power or seek to diminish it, I am so much more powerful than you that I will be able to destroy you. And that's what Ronan Farrow's story is about. And that is, it's that power imbalance that is at the heart of these stories
of
abuse and harassment, not just the monstrously violent ones that are about Harvey and his behavior, but about the sort of daily realities of workplace harassment and degradation that many women and some men face in contemporary and past workplaces.
But, you know, we have to ask, what should our response be to all these stories as they are coming out? What should we in the general public feel, and I include myself, as we hear about these stories? Should it be a new resolve? Should it be a coming forward? Should it be a sense we will not let this continue? What should it be?
Oh, I wish I knew. The answers aren't simple. Yes, of course, we should keep on telling the truth about what's happened. One of the remarkable things, and I think it comes in part because the story about Harvey was so enormous and so shocking that it blew a massive, unignorable hole in the news cycle. In that hole, that space that it created, has allowed dozens, scores, hundreds of women now to come forward with their stories. And that's a good thing.
Not just about Harvey Weinstein, but
right.
Indeed, at NPR about Michael Oreskes. And all of these men who are exactly, as you say, in positions of power.
Right. So there are now all of these women, and I'll tell you that in my work, because I report on women and power and women in politics, I have gotten, it's been a very hard and shocking 5 or 6 weeks, because ever since the Harvey story is broken, I get somewhere between 5 and 20 emails or messages a day from women telling me about their experiences with this whole range of behaviors. Again, and we know there's a difference, right? We know there's a difference between allegations of rape and allegations of having had a boss sort of grab you or proposition you. But I'm hearing these stories every day. It's so ubiquitous. And that's one of the things that we need to really wrap our heads around, that it's not just these extraordinary monsters, that this is the everyday. how do we solve it? You know, the thing I keep coming back to is one of the hardest things to do, because it means really grappling with and looking straight in the face of the inequities that have defined so much about the public sphere and the
exactly.
political sphere and the professional sphere.
Exactly.
We need more women in power. We tell ourselves that we're post-feminist. We tell ourselves that we now have grown around gender and race and the kind of inequities on which this country really was built, and we don't like to look too hard at those inequities. And we tell ourselves, oh, we've grown so much. We had a feminist movement. We had a civil rights movement. You know, we've had a black president. And we don't like to think or talk about the fact that those problems, you know, the impact of disproportionate power in the hands of white men is not a problem of our past and not a problem of our history. It is very much a reality of our present and, you know, our immediate future. And these kinds of trespasses are permitted, and the kinds of forgiveness that then permits men to get their next job, even when they've lost the last
exactly.
one for something like this. It's enabled by the fact that it's other white men who have all this power. The only fix is a future in which we think about having more women, more people of color in power. Because if the power is still in the hands of men, these kinds of things are going to continue happening.
Well, and men themselves need to start speaking out, not only when they have been trespassed on by other men, but taking responsibility for what they have done and are doing.
And what they have profited from, even if they didn't have a hand in doing it. And that's the harder thing. One of the conversations we've recently had about race, thanks in part to the work of Ta-Nehisi Coates and others, is about the way that racial privilege redounds to all kinds of white people, even if they themselves have not engaged in outright racism,
yep.
right? That the benefits
yep.
of whiteness in this country are, I enjoy those benefits. You enjoy those benefits. There are similar realities about gender, that even the good men, even the men who've never inappropriately touched anyone, even they have also enjoyed an ample share of power, and their voices have been granted an ample share of authority. They haven't, in many cases, although I know obviously some men have experienced harassment and abuse, they haven't had to navigate their entire careers around these behaviors, big and small, worrying about how their reactions are going to impact their professional reality. They have not had to make their careers and their fortunes around being disempowered professionally, economically, sexually.
And that's what I begin to wonder about, whether this avalanche of accusations, not only against Harvey Weinstein, but against many other men, the latest of whom is Roy Moore, are we going to see a change, a sea change in not only media culture, but women who are more willing to stand up and say, this has happened to me, and I am going to look to my offender and call him out?
Well, let me say that I was pretty pessimistic on that front. As I was working on this piece that I'm finishing for New York Magazine about these dynamics right now, I felt pretty pessimistic over, you know, up until Monday of this week. Thinking this moment's going to pass, the backlash is going to come. And all the women I know predict that any day now we're going to get the backlash. We're the witch hunters. We're persecuting these poor men, driving them out of jobs. You can already hear it building in some quarters, that this is a pile on. These offenses aren't really this serious. It's men being men. Not everybody's Harvey Weinstein. I've been just waiting for that axe to fall, the window of opportunity to tell our stories to close hard on us and to be punished. But one of the things that I've been thinking about, and this doesn't officially have to do with the question of sexual harassment, is watching the election results on Tuesday and hearing the stories of these women who were angry, and angry not about sexual assault, but about power imbalance. Danica Rome, who is a transgender candidate who ran against an incumbent long-term Republican who had written the anti-trans bathroom bill and beat him. The woman in New Jersey who had gotten mad because the incumbent Republican had made a disparaging comment after the Women's March and had gotten mad, run against him, and beat him. That is an example. Those things. I'm working on a book about women, anger, and politics, and the force of anger, women's anger specifically, in our entire history of social and political change. And Tuesday seemed to me to offer a path forward. That if there is this much anger that women and this much desire on the part of women to say, wait, no, we want to talk now about the circumstances in which we've been living. That if that anger can get translated to things like electoral participation, as we saw on Tuesday, if it can get translated into political engagement, to involvement in social movements, of course, the Women's March was another example of this, then what we can do is not just punish the men who are in power, but try to take more power for ourselves.
And Rebecca, one last point, a Facebook comment we had from Catherine, who says, it seems all news venues are mum about Trump's behavior toward women now that he is president. How far up the chain do you think this could go?
You know, there was this moment a year ago, and this is one of the reasons that I think the rage right now is so out of control and raw. Because if you'll remember, almost exactly a year ago, in the weeks leading up to the 2016 election, there was the spate of stories about the allegations, I think more than 20 women, with allegations that Donald Trump had groped them, harassed them, his own confession of sorts in that Access Hollywood tape that you can just do whatever you want when you're famous, you can grab them. And there couldn't be any clearer cut case. And around that, there was uproar. I remember the women being angry. I remember hashtag campaigns on Twitter, people explaining the first time they'd been assaulted. There was an uproar, and it didn't matter. He was elected anyway. And even more than that, 3 million more people voted for his opponent, and he was elected anyway. It was a perfect metaphor for how we feel powerless. We couldn't stop this guy. Even when it was exposed, even when women came together and told their stories, even when we were outraged about it, even when more people voted for his opponent, the guy still got to be president. And I think that's part of what's contributed to the explosive nature of the rage this time. It's been a year with this guy. Nobody cares that he confesses to grabbing women against their will. Nobody cared. Nobody cares to this day that there are these 20 women telling really horrible stories about him forcibly kissing them or groping them on airplanes. We just don't care. And that is part of what has made women so angry that they've exploded in this way. Do I have hope that it's going to bring down Trump? No, I wish I did. I wish I had hope that that was going to be the thing that got Trump. But I think we had the opportunity to do that and it didn't work. It's not even that we didn't do it. It didn't work. Everybody did what they were supposed to do, except perhaps the media that covered it or covered it up or muted it. But it didn't work. It didn't work. He's the president. And so part of why we're getting this right now is because he's the president. But I don't know that I have any hope that this particular complaint is going to be his undoing.
Rebecca, I can't thank you enough for being on with us. You've been just terrific. And
thank you.
Keep talking. Keep saying what has happened to you and reporting on other women. It's so important. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Joining me here in our Washington, D.C. studio is Dan Rather. He's founder, president, and CEO of News and Guts, an independent production company. He's former anchor and managing editor for CBS News. His new book is titled What Unites Us. Dan Rather, how great to see you again.
So lovely to see you, and again, congratulations on your recent wedding.
Thank you so much. Tuesday's elections. Talk about your reactions.
Well, first of all, I was at least mildly surprised. I can't say shocked, because as you and I know, having been around a while, there's an ebb and flow to American politics. And the history of that ebb and flow is when things move sort of forcefully in one direction, right or left, fairly quickly there's a corrective. And this speaks well for us as a country. We're not a perfect country, and as we all know, but one of the things we're pretty good about is being steady. There's a chapter in What Unites Us about being steady. We're pretty steady. But I was mildly surprised at how big the Democrats' win was, given their loss in the last presidential election, given the splits and fissures within their own party. I thought that they might have some victories, but nothing overwhelming. This was, in political terms, a tidal wave. I won't say a full tsunami, but a big tidal wave with, I think, far-reaching probable implications for the Republican Party.
Like what?
Well, like any Republican who's on the ballot in 2018, congressman or senator, the results of this election will make their fingernails sweat. Now, overnight's a long time in politics. A week is forever. And these victories by the Democrats in this particular turn of the election wheel do not necessarily portend what's going to happen in 2018. But one result is to really make the Republicans worry. Can they hold on to the House in 2018? I still think the odds are they will. But this lowers the odds quite a bit. So there is that. The second, in sort of inside politics analysis, the most important thing the Republicans have to worry about is the shift in the suburban vote. Our country is becoming increasingly suburban. Donald Trump did quite well. One of the keys to his victory was his strength in the suburbs, including strength among women, which surprised a lot of people. This election went the other way. And rather consistently through the returns, not unanimously, but consistently through the returns, the suburbs were turning Democratic.
So does that mean you think that this was truly a referendum on President Trump?
I don't think there's any doubt that it was a referendum on President Trump. There were other factors. As you know, health care was the issue in which most people who came out of the polls said they were most concerned about. But look, by any objective, reasonable analysis, this was a referendum on Trump, and he lost. That doesn't mean that this, as I say, is going to hold for the next year through the 2018 elections. But for this moment in time, yes, it was a strong vote. People saying we don't like the tone of the presidency, what the president tweets, what he says. Because, as you know, Diane, Americans want some sense of nobility in their president. They want to believe in the basic decency of their president. And given the rhetoric, both in tweet written and stated by this president, it's pretty hard to come away with any conclusion anywhere near that.
Dan, how do you speak to the criticism that it was the media that saw to it that Donald Trump was elected?
Well, you know, I've tried to edit myself some on Texas sayings, but one is very apt in this kind. That old dog won't hunt. It's very easy and always handy to say it's the media's fault. It's the media. But when Donald Trump won the presidential election, he insisted it was despite the media. Then when he loses, he says, well, it's because of the media. I think most Americans, including many of those who remain Trump supporters, would agree that most people make their own decisions, and they make decisions on such things as pocketbook issues, what the economy is doing, or what they think about health care, and on what they think the tone of the presidency is. The media is not perfect. We make our mistakes. I've certainly made our mistakes. But by and large, I think the American people understand that an important role of the press is to be part of our system of checks and balances. And most presidents at one time or another complain about the press, some more than others. Richard Nixon complained about the press. But again, nothing at the level that President Trump has done, and nothing as personal as he has done. Some of his attacks on the press have been on the press as a whole, saying they're, this is not a direct quote, the essence is that they're among the worst people in our society, that they're, quote, enemies of the people, which is a rather scary reflection of an authoritarian frame of mind and of political office. But I just don't think that that sells. And I don't think any reasonable person making an analysis of the last election results would say it's the media's fault.
I'd be interested in your response to why Hillary lost.
Well, we could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about
sure.
that, of course. But among the reasons, the Democratic Party did not run a very smart campaign. In fact, in some ways, it ran a dumb campaign. Such things as ignoring states such as Michigan and Wisconsin, not putting resources in at the last minute, as the Trump forces did. So the Democratic Party ran not a smart campaign. Secondly, and there's no joy in saying this, but Hillary Clinton did not connect with a lot of Americans, including American women. Some of it was the simple fact that she was a woman. And while many people, particularly many women, assume that all women will vote for a woman because they want a woman president, that proved not to be true, that some women were not prepared to have a woman president, and particularly this particular woman. And the most important thing, Diane, that at least in my opinion, is this. I've been covering politics as boy and man for now over 70 years, if you can believe that. And whether it's a race for mayor or city council or county supervisor or governor or president, when you have a situation in which one candidate exudes a image of strength but not such good principles, and the other candidate exudes pretty good principles but not strength, most of the time strength wins. And that was Donald Trump's trump card.
As you watch what's unfolding with the Mueller investigation, the Senate investigations, how much do you think back to Watergate and wonder whether we are going to see the unraveling of a presidency?
Well, naturally, my mind goes back fairly often to the Watergate period, because there is what I call a bloodline running between the widespread criminal conspiracy that we call for shorthand Watergate and what's happening here in the second decade of the 20th century. However, we can try to draw too many comparisons. Different time, different situation, different presidents, and there was this important difference. The criminal conspiracy that was Watergate involved almost overwhelmingly, almost entirely, domestic criminality. It was Americans perpetrating crimes and threats to the Constitution against other Americans. In the current situation, the absolute fundamental core of the Mueller investigation deals with whether a foreign power, Russia, affected the election. It's a fact, there's no question, that they attempted to affect the election, that they intended to raise into question the stability of our democracy. So the Mueller investigation, compared with the investigation, Watergate dealt with crimes led by a president of the United States and by his underlings that involved constitutional questions and other illegalities that were domestic. The Mueller investigation involves the real peril of a foreign power determined to use its resources to create instability at the least and maybe influence election is a vast difference.
At the same time, you have people who are very close to the president, at least were very close to the president. For example, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And there seems to be a great deal of interest in exactly how much he was involved and how close that might bring the investigation to the president himself.
Absolutely, no question. And the son-in-law's involvement, or alleged involvement, we should say, is obviously a main target of the Mueller investigation, no doubt about it. But I do feel obliged to say, Diane, that we live, thank heaven, here in the United States of America, and I try to point this out, in United We Stand. We're dedicated to both the idea and the ideal that every person is entitled to a presumption of innocence until proven otherwise. And while we do have suspicions about what the president himself may have done in terms of, may have done, colluding with the Russians, what his son-in-law did, and we'll find out the facts as time goes along. But in the meantime, they are entitled to a presumption of innocence. But back to your question, Mueller is looking into the son-in-law's involvement and a whole host of other people in doing what prosecutors do, and that is pick people at the lower levels, find crimes they have committed, and then say to them, in effect, you get to choose. I can send you to prison for a long time, or you can tell me what you know. And that's where the Mueller investigation is now. I do find, Diane, that a lot of people that I run across expect to find out pretty quickly the results of the Mueller investigation. I'd be surprised if that turns out to be the case. It's a complex case.
You think
case.
It's going to go on it's and going on to take, for it's quite going, some time.
I think it's going to go on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And that would include possibly even beyond the 2018 congressional elections. I wouldn't be surprised. There's one other point we should mention in this regard. When people talk about, well, it's possible we reach a point where there'll be a move to impeach President Trump. There are already some people making moves in that direction. It would take overwhelming evidence of really serious crimes, in my judgment, to have that happen with President Trump. I think particularly some Democrats who just can't stand Trump find themselves thinking, just waiting for the day he gets impeached. And I'm simply saying that may not happen. And among other reasons, it may not happen because of this, that the Republicans control both the Senate and the House. With President Nixon in Watergate, the Democrats controlled. With President Clinton in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, the Republicans controlled. And because impeachment, articles of impeachment, can only be voted by the House of Representatives, as long as the Republicans control the lower house, then it's going to be very difficult to impeach President Trump, whatever the evidence shows.
I want to turn to your tweets, because it seems to me that you've been pretty tough on Trump.
Well, on Twitter and Facebook, our social media thing, I think that's fair to say that it's not in me. Part of this may be Diane's age. You're still a very young woman by my standards. But when you reach my age and stage and you love the country, I love this country deeply, and you see a situation in which the country is deepening into a period of peril, you say to yourself, gosh, at this late stage of life, I can't stay silent. So other people will have to judge how well or how poorly I've done it. But I've tried not to question President Trump's motives, but to question his judgment and his statements, what he has said himself, and to in effect say, you know, this is not America. This is not a proper reflection of who we are as a people. Some of these things that the president's been saying, things that are in effect a wink-wink to people who are racially bigoted, the Ku Klux Klan and others, having people on his staff who have a long history of bigotry, in some cases at least suggestions of anti-Semitism. I just said to myself, you know, now I'm not at CBS News. I work for myself, with myself, in a very small company. I have no one to answer to but myself. And just say, you know, to hell with it. What people think, that old Clark Gable line from Gone with the Wind, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. I'm going to tell you what I think. I tell you what my own assessment, my judgment is on what President Trump is doing. And I do think we've seen a reflection of this in this last election, which we talked about earlier in the program, of people just saying, look, we're not going to let Trumpism capture the country because it's hurting us. In the eyes of the world, we've been diminished by the Trump presidency. That's not a partisan political statement. By any reasonable assessment, that's what's happened. And people are waking up and saying to themselves, many people, I can agree with some of the policies that President Trump is talking about. We do need to have a meaningful conversation about such things as immigration and the great disparity between immense wealth and the shrinking of the middle class. All of those are things we should be discussing, and we can have differences of opinion. The purpose that in writing the book was to say, all that aside, let's pull back for what we call in television the wide shot and take a view of those values that have sustained the country for more than well over 200 years.
At the same time, as you said, you are no longer with CBS. Do you believe you were treated unfairly?
Short answer is yes. But, Diane, it's been 12 years ago. I rarely think of it anymore. I had a great run at CBS News. I love the people there, love the place, still do. And, you know, life goes up and down. Life is not always fair. That I lost my job at CBS because we reported a true story that was vulnerable by those who wanted to attack the process by which we got the truth.
About George W. Bush and his membership in the armed forces or not.
That's right. But as I say, it's been a long time ago. It's been my rearview mirror for ages. I rarely even think about it anymore because I've been very lucky, let's face it, and very blessed. What I'm doing now is some of the best work of my career. Now, I know there were people who say, well, that's damning with very faint praise, but nonetheless, I enjoy what I'm doing now. I have a sense that it matters. I'm working on the periphery. I no longer work for a big network, but I enjoy what I'm doing, and I do think it counts. It may count microscopically, but I think it counts, and I'm having some of the most satisfying work that I've ever done.
Why do you think it is each and every time we've had mass murders in the last few months that public officials continue to say, now is not the time to talk about guns?
Well, as I always try to do, Diane, I'm going to talk straight to you. The basic reason is money. That the people who say that are by and large either making money off the sales of guns and ammunition, or there are people who have accepted campaign contributions and they think their political future depends on it. That's the answer that many people want to dance around as to why we have that situation each and every time. Politicians in both parties, I'm not engaging in false equivalents, one fair to say more in the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, but in both parties, is saying, well, yes, we need to do something about guns, but now is not the time.
They keep switching this subject to mental health.
Look, mental health is a problem in the country.
Absolutely.
We have a problem with mental health.
Of course we do.
But, you know, to argue time after time, everything from South Carolina to the most recent shooting in my home state of Texas, and each and every time to say, ooh, it's not guns, it's mental health. Please. I think this is an insult to the American people.
Absolutely.
The American people are very good at separating brass tacks from bullshine, and they understand that this argument that, well, these shootings are a mental health problem. Mental health, again, I want to say for emphasis, is a huge problem in the country. However, having the kind of situation we do with guns is in many ways ridiculous. I come from a gun culture in Texas. I grew up with guns. I grew up hunting. I own a gun now. My father's shotgun. I understand about guns. But, you know, we don't allow people to have a tank. We don't allow people to have a flamethrower. We have regulations on weapons. And the idea that the kind of semi-automatic weapon that was used in this most recent case in Texas, that someone with a mental health record can get that kind of weapon needs to be addressed. And I do think that public opinion is moving somewhat in that direction, not to do away with the Second Amendment, not to have some draconian gun control measures, but to take at least some many steps to prevent as best we can. We're never going to wipe out gun violence. We're going to have these situations, but we can reduce the number of them by taking just some common sense steps along the way, i.e., making it much more difficult for certain people, including people with many problems, to have weapons. But the National Rifle Association, which has many good members who, by the way, feel that we need better control of guns, but the leadership of the National Rifle Association, which is financed by people who manufacture guns and sell ammunition for guns, the idea that no amount of legislation ever should be directed toward guns is not in step with public opinion. But your original point, we're still at the point where politicians generally say, yes, yes, Diane and Dan, others, you're right about it, but now is not the time.
Now is not the time. Last question. You write in your book that the American media is currently in a state of crisis. What do you mean, and what would you propose to do about that?
Well, the American media is in crisis for a number of reasons. Two of the leading reasons are, one, it's under forceful and unrelenting attack, an unprecedented attack by the President of the United States. For example, saying that people in the media, in the press, everybody, are enemies of the people, quote unquote. This is authoritarian language. It's dangerous language of a sort that dictators have used perennially, and needs to be recognized for what it is. It's a problem for journalists such as myself, but more importantly, it should be a matter of concern for every American. So that's one thing. There's an unrelenting, consistent effort by some of the most powerful people in the country, including the president, to cast the press, try to intimidate the press, and try to convince people that they are, quote, enemies of the state. That's number one. The second thing is with the press itself. The crisis is born partly because we have a shrinking number of really independent news outlets, that the old business model is either dead or going, and a new business model, with very few exceptions, has not yet been developed that can finance first-class international reporting, deep-digging investigative reporting. Now, I do think we need to add, those of us in journalism need to add, look, we've made our mistakes. I certainly have made mine. We're not perfect. We're going to make mistakes. And when we make mistakes, it's important that we transparently come forward and admit the mistake, tell how it was made, be transparent about it. So we have some responsibility, those of us in journalism. But the main factors are the two I mentioned.
Dan Rather, it's always good to see you, to talk with you. Thank you for being here.
Diane, thank you very much.
My pleasure. And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, DianeWeem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced this week by Allison Brody and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.